Order.
This judicial review of the Federal Court heard in Ottawa is now open. Presiding the Honorable Justice Fothergill, before the court, the Federal Court file number T-1769-25, sorry, between Joseph Hickey versus the Attorney General of Canada. Appearing as the applicant, we have Joseph Hickey, and appearing on behalf of the respondent, we have Rebecca Ferris and Lucky Ingavir.
Mr. Hickey, you want to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can you hear me all right?
I can, yes.
Good afternoon. First, I would like to note that I have raised two issues in my application, which are stated at paragraph 29, called issue one, and paragraph 30, issue two, of my memorandum of fact and law. I would like to withdraw issue two, which relates to my argument that the Canadian Employment Insurance Commission's decision itself violates my fundamental rights, and which is argued in section 3.3 and paragraphs 122 to 132 of my memorandum. Instead, I will focus entirely on issue one, which relates to the definition of misconduct as it applies to my case. And I'll begin my submission. But if I first zoom out, the crux of the matter is that the tribunals and courts have in recent years settled on a definition of the statutory word misconduct in the Employment Insurance Act to mean any willful non-compliance, knowingly leading to dismissal, irrespective of the nature and contents of what is being imposed by the employer. In cases in which what is being imposed is benign and legal on the face of the facts, or is an objectively necessary part of the employment, then application of this adopted definition poses no particular problem. However, in other cases, the same definition applied formulaically can lead to absurd or untenable results. My case falls in the latter category and is distinguished from all other cases for the following reasons. First, in my case, it is conclusively established by substantial and uncontested documentary scientific evidence on the record, including autopsy studies, that the COVID-19 vaccines can cause serious and potentially fatal harm to a person in my age and sex group, that is, males under 40. And I was 36 in November 2021 when I was suspended without pay for not being vaccinated. The said uncontested evidence was brought at every stage from employer through Social Security Tribunal General Division via affidavit and forward. This is acknowledged by the SST Appeal Division in its following statement at paragraph 26 of its decision denying me leave to appeal. And I'll quote. As a data scientist, he says he is eminently qualified to speak about the dangers of vaccination. He provided scientific evidence about the risks, particularly for someone of his profile, in taking the vaccine. Again, that was at paragraph 26 of the decision denying leave to appeal dated May 7, 2025. Now, the second reason my case is distinguished is that in my case, there was no public health need for me to take the vaccine, since I worked entirely from home with no contact with my colleagues who also work entirely from home, which is also uncontested and acknowledged by the SST Appeal Division, again at paragraph 26 of the decision denying leave to appeal.
I think what the tribunal is saying is that tribunal's job is not to look into the reasonableness of the employer's behavior. Those are labor law issues. And the only thing the tribunal is concerned with is whether the behavior that resulted in your suspension was intentional or not. So there seems to be a division of responsibility such that if you want to challenge the reasonableness of your employer's policies, and I express no view on that, then you should have filed a grievance. And my understanding is that indeed many grievances have been filed about precisely this, about the government's COVID vaccination policy. And I think there may be quite good arguments that it was overbroad, that there was insufficient accommodation. These are all legitimate arguments that can be made, but the question is, can they be made here? And from the tribunal's point of view, those kinds of arguments are the proper subject of grievance, but they're not the proper subject of a complaint about not receiving EI. And I'm wondering how you respond to that.
Yes, and that will be addressed clearly in my submissions. I'm not challenging the reasonableness of the policy, but the crux of my argument is that when there is a conclusively proven and scientifically documented risk of harm to the individual, then that risk of harm that is part of the employer's demand to the employee must be, in my respectful submission, must be taken into account in the decision maker's calculus of about misconduct under the Employment Term Act. And I'm going to state that perhaps
Yes,
a bit
all
more
right.
clearly as I go on.
I mean, you're fundamentally saying you were justified in not complying with the employer policy because the policy was unreasonable.
I disagree. I believe that when the decision maker decides whether an action constitutes misconduct,
Yes.
the decision maker needs to consider what that action is. And when the action is a refusal of a directive from an employer, then to properly consider what the action is, one needs to consider what the customer being demanded.
That's right. So that's the reasonableness of the employer's policy.
I disagree, and I think that if you let me
Yes.
proceed, I think it.
I'm just trying to focus in on what I think is the central issue, because it's not going to be important to me how strong your case is about whether the COVID vaccine was dangerous or not, because that's not the issue. The issue here is whether your conduct was intentional or not, and whether you engaged that conduct knowing that there might be employment consequences. And certainly from the tribunal's point of view, you did know. You knew that when you refused to comply with the vaccine policy, that you could be suspended, and in fact, you were. And if you were unhappy with that result, you could file a grievance. You didn't. You sought employment insurance, which was denied. And so the issue for this court is whether that decision was reasonable, not whether the employer's vaccination policy was reasonable. As I understand the law, Parliament made a decision that the EI process would deal with issues of intention. And if you have a labor law, well, you take that somewhere else. You take that to a labor somebody, labor relations.
It is important to note that I was not unionized, so grievance is not
Doesn't
relevant,
matter.
but it could be perhaps some other
No, a
venue.
non-unionized employee can bring grievance as well. So,
Okay, but I would like to say
yes,
that
and
it's
then
not.
I'm happy for you to present your cases if you
Okay.
think best, but I think it's only fair to you to tell you what I think the main issue here is,
I
which
understand.
is, are we dealing with a labor law question, which would be the reasonableness of the employer's policy, or are we dealing with a question of intentionality, which is what the tribunal thinks is the only thing that matters?
I believe we're dealing with the decision maker's calculus for determining this conduct pursuant to the employment shutdown.
Right.
It's an action that the social tribunal, security tribunal has to decide, is it misconduct or not? And when you have, that means you have to fully consider what the action is. And if
Wait,
the
you want to
real,
say a principled objection is not misconduct? Is that fair to say?
well, I would respond as follows. It's more specific than that. If the risk of significant and irreversible harm is part of both the factual basis and the stated employee's reason for not complying with the employer's demand, then the said risk must be part of the decision maker's calculus in determining misconduct.
I don't understand why you say that's not a criticism of the reasonableness of the employer's policy.
It's not about having a declaration that the policy is invalid, about making any kind of statement about the policy. It's about the employee's action. It's the employee's action. Does the employee's action constitute misconduct? And misconduct is not defined in the Act.
No.
And so the definition of misconduct and the analysis that is applied by this decision maker has to comply with the spirit and intent of the Act. And so when there is that risk of harm in the factual basis and the employee's reason for not complying, then that risk has to be part of this decision maker's calculus. They cannot ignore the fact that there's a risk of serious harm to the individual from refusing when they consider whether that refusal constitutes misconduct.
I think I have to point out that, of course, the policy did not require vaccination. It just imposed certain consequences if an employee did not become vaccinated. So you didn't have to undergo vaccination, indeed you didn't. It's just that as a result, you were suspended. So it's not that the employer is forcing you to take a vaccine, you have no choice.
My action was to decline vaccination and request an accommodation of my employer's policy.
Right.
And I did pursue that diligently and fully. And it was an open-ended process, and my employer received my follow-up submissions, which makes a large part of the record for today.
Yes.
But that is. What it really boils down to is my action of not being vaccinated in the context that is the facts of my case. So there was proven risk of harm to me, a person my age, etc., that is uncontested, is documented with scientific evidence on the record. And there was no need because for me to be vaccinated because I worked entirely from home. All of my colleagues worked entirely from home. And I had no contact with any other person, member of the public or otherwise, as part of my work. I was isolated as far as my work was concerned. So in those facts, in that set of facts, which is my case, the action of refusing the demand that brings with it a serious risk of harm to me, proven on the record, untested risk of harm to me, that has to be part of the analysis of this conduct. So
I'm struggling to understand why that's not a criticism of the reasonableness of the employer's policy. You just said, well, you're working from home, so it was completely unnecessary. Sounds like a criticism of policy to me. You said you shouldn't have had to take a vaccine that was harmful. Sounds like a criticism of policy to me. How are these things not criticisms of the employer's policies?
I disagree. It is not a criticism of the policy itself. It is the facts of the demand that was placed on me
Yes.
that are relevant to deciding whether my action of refusing constitutes misconduct of intelligence by the
You're
treasurer.
saying the demand was unreasonable and therefore your conduct was justified.
I'm not saying that the demand was unreasonable per se. I'm saying that my refusal was a refusal of something that could have caused me harm, and that is documented, is on the record. It's conclusive scientific evidence about myocarditis and pericarditis, which are dangerous types of heart inflammation, which are irreversible and which have been proven to kill younger males with autism settings. So this is a real risk of harm, and I refuse that. And the facts of my case are also that there was no need for that anyway. That's a distinguishing factor compared to other cases. So that aspect, which is the real proven risk of harm, in my submission, has to be part of the decision maker's analysis for their calculus when they decide whether that action was misconduct or not. If I may, I'll go back to what I just prepared the statement. And so I had said that the second factor distinguishing my case is that there was no public health need for me to take the vaccine, since I work entirely from home with no contact with my colleagues who also work entirely from home, which is also uncontested and acknowledged by the SSD appeal division. Again, at paragraph 36 of the decision denied me to appeal. The impugned non-compliance in my case was a refusal to receive a preventative medical treatment by injection with proven risk of significant and irreversible harm to me, specifically myocarditis and pericarditis, which can lead to death. While all my colleagues and I work entirely from home, the said risks to young males are proven by uncontested facts on the record of my case, are not hypothetical, and are publicly recognized by the leading health authorities. These two facts, one, heart inflammation risk of death to my age group and sex established on the record, and two, the proven work from home context, distinguish my case from all other cases that have come before this court or the Federal Court of Appeal.
Well, there are a number of cases that come before this court and Court of Appeal dealing specifically with people who refuse to comply with the vaccination requirements during the COVID pandemic. So how is your case different?
Yes. Well, it's those two factors that I just mentioned.
Well, those factors would be present in all these other cases, too.
No, not those two factors.
No?
No. No. None of the cases that are about misconduct under the Employment Insurance Act or refusing vaccination have the same factual basis. But they're distinguished on it. It's not just they're distinguished based on these two factors that I mentioned. So they've proven, established on the risk, on the record, risk of heart inflammation, risk of death, my age and sex group. That's one factor, and the other factor is a proven work from home context. No other these factors distinguish my case from all the other ones that have come before this court and the Federal Court of Appeal. I have a few examples to kind of illustrate that. The Social Security Tribunal refused to consider the established and uncontested risk of bodily harm to me from the employer's demand in its calculus of whether my refusal to be vaccinated amounted to misconduct. This error, which is a failure to decide an issue that the SST should have decided, is at the heart of issue one of my judicial review. Nothing in the home statute excludes or prevents or makes irrelevant a consideration of this factual context, of the nature of the employer's demand in determining statutory misconduct. Basically, in a nutshell, my argument might be expressed as follows. Point one, the tribunal must treat each separate case and not apply generic formulas. Part two, the oft-quoted analytic rule to exclude as irrelevant whatever the employer demand might be leads to absurdity in cases like mine. Point three, the said rule does not come from the statute, and is not, in cases like mine, consistent with the meaning, intent, and purpose of the law. Now, issue one of this judicial review is stated at paragraph 29 of my memorandum of fact and law as follows. Did my refusal to follow my employer's demand to accept the medical intervention of injecting a substance into the body that can cause long-term or permanent disability and death constitute misconduct to justifying depriving me of employment insurance benefits pursuant to the Employment Insurance Act? There must be a limit beyond which a deleterious health effect from complying with an employer's demand is unquestionably expressly relevant to the determination of misconduct pursuant to the EI Act. Misconduct in the spirit, purpose, and intent of the Act cannot, in all cases, be determined irrespective of the nature and consequences of the employer's demand. In the case of an employer demanding that an employee receive a potentially lethal preventative medical injection, which is unnecessary for competently performing the work, where would the decision maker place that limit? The population of males under 40 in Canada as of 2025 is approximately 10 million. Would safety be considered in the decision maker's misconduct analysis if the refused injection was proven to kill one person out of 10 million? What if the injection killed 10 people out of 10 million? Or what if it eventually killed 1,000 people out of 10 million? Respectfully, if the risk of significant and irreversible harm is part of both the factual basis and the stated employee's reason for not complying with the employer's demand, then the said risk must be part of the decision maker's calculus in determining misconduct. In the decisions below, the SST explicitly refused to make any consideration of the nature and personal health consequences of my employer's demand.
Because the tribunal felt that that would involve it in assessing the reasonableness of the employer's behavior, which it saw as a labor law question, not an entitlement to benefits question. So you're right. They didn't deal with that because they said that wasn't their job. So to succeed in this court, you're going to have to persuade me that the tribunal was wrong in limiting its role in the way that it did. But I think the challenge for you is that similar cases have gone up to the Court of Appeal, and the Court of Appeal has confirmed that it's not the role of the tribunal to assess the employer's policy. Now, I know you say that's not what you are arguing, but it seems to be that effectively you are, because you're saying some consideration has to be given to the nature of the demand the employer is making. And I do understand your perspective. You're saying this is an unreasonable policy, and you were justified in not complying. And that might be a very compelling argument, but it should be made by way of a grievance, not in the context of an EI claim.
My argument today is not about the reasonableness of the policy.
I don't know how you can dispute that, because you say that what the tribunal did wrong is they didn't consider the nature of the demand that was made of you. Well, that's the employer's policy.
My argument is about the misconduct analysis.
Yes.
That it has to, it cannot in all cases exclude harm to the employee if they were to comply with the hearing.
Well, you have one case that talks about that. And that's the case where somebody said they wouldn't go to work because of the harassment and the workplace was unsafe. And there the inquiry was whether that affected the intentionality of the employer's, say, the employee's behavior. But that's not really your case, because you know your actions were intentional. You knew what you were doing, and you knew the risks you were taking. But you felt those risks were justified. And that makes it more of a labor law case than an employment insurance case.
Whether what I might have felt about risks, and this is not something that's on the record, my feelings about this. So I don't know exactly what I felt for the risks from
Well,
this.
you've just been explaining to me the very serious risk as you see it of taking this vaccine.
This is not, as I see it, this is documented scientific evidence. It's something that's
Right, but you're
considered
talking
critical.
about the risk to you of taking this
Yeah,
vaccine.
yes,
Yes,
that's right.
that's where it's kind of record. You're on the card.
I submit that there was proven real risk to me. Should I have taken
Yes, and that might have formed the basis for reviews.
I come back to my argument, which is that when a decision maker evaluates misconduct, evaluates an employee's action of refusing a directive to determine whether or not that's misconduct. There would be many cases where it's taken for granted that it's objectively clear that the employee's action of refusing a directive is obviously the kind of thing that would get them suspended or get them fired. And in that case, the test that the Social Security Tribunal has applied is not problematic. That is a test where it would be, that is a case where it would be appropriate. It's when there is a risk of harm to the employee that is avoided by not complying with the demand, that the test is inappropriate. That the test excludes any consideration of potential harm to the employee or potential harm to someone else. And that is not consistent with the purpose and intent of the act. And if I could continue,
Yes.
the SST adopted a so-called test for misconduct that excludes any consideration of what was being demanded by my employer and refused by me while claiming to be bound by court decisions in doing so. However, none of the cases that have come before this court or the Federal Court of Appeal regarding misconduct pursuant to the EI Act due to refusing vaccines have considered when an employer's demand could be legitimately refused. In my respectful submission, there must be that limit beyond which it is legitimate to refuse an employer's demand, and employees must be heard in cases in which it is argued that that limit has been surpassed, such as the incident case. I respectfully ask the court to send the incident case back to the SST so that it can be reevaluated in light of the need to recognize that, in at least some cases, and in my case in particular, the misconduct analysis requires consideration of what was being refused and its potentially grave impacts on an employee's health and safety. The next section of my presentation is an overview of the uncontested scientific evidence of potential harm from the COVID-19 vaccines to someone in my age and sex group. There are 5 points.
Right, I mean,
This is
the
not all of
tribunal
them.
didn't deal with this because they didn't think this was something within their jurisdiction. Now, I understand you say that that's an error. I can give you that point in mind, that it's open to you to say this is a harmful vaccine. And you have evidence to back that up. I think there's evidence that goes the other way, but that's fine. You have evidence to support your position that the tribunal didn't do.
There's uncontested evidence that's on the record, scientifically proven that a person in my age and sex group is at
Has some
risk of
risk, yes.
significantly elevated dangerous heart inflammation. So it can be, it can cause permanent disability, irreversible damage, up to and including death. That is uncontested and it's on the record.
Yes.
And I would just like to summarize that 5 points. As noted in my memorandum of fact and law, paragraphs 21 and 22, the uncontested scientific evidence on the record before the tribunal and in the instant judicial review includes, point one, more than 1,000 peer-reviewed scientific articles demonstrating harm from COVID-19 vaccine, many of which concern cases of myocarditis in younger males. Point two, autopsy studies of death caused by COVID-19 vaccines, especially due to myocarditis in younger males. Point three, government health agency studies of serious adverse event reports following COVID-19 vaccination using pharmacovigilance systems such as the Vaccine Adverse Events Reporting System in the United States, Public Health Ontario's Adverse Events Database, and Pfizer's Database of Adverse Event Reports made following injection with its COVID-19 vaccine product. Point four, numerous peer-reviewed published studies showing the significantly increased risk of dangerous heart inflammation, myocarditis, and pericarditis following COVID-19 vaccination, especially for younger males, which danger is heightened for those who engage in strenuous sports activity with large cardiovascular demand, which I do, as I have affirmed in my affidavit on the record. Point five, reported announcements of government public health agencies in many countries removing authorization for COVID-19 vaccines due to serious and fatal adverse events, in many cases due to recognition of the significantly increased risk of myocarditis and pericarditis for younger males following COVID-19 vaccination. Now, the next section of my presentation is entitled Examples of How Key Federal Court and Federal Court of Appeal Cases Regarding Misconduct for Refusing Vaccination Do Not Have Force of Precedent in My Case. Just take a drink of water. The first case is Cachetto versus Canada, which went to the Federal Court of Appeal. But there was also a federal court decision in that case, which was 2023 FC 102. And that federal court decision contains the following statement at paragraph 32.
So which case are you in here?
Cachetto.
Cachetto, this is in your list. Oh, yes, I see it. So you want to go to the Court of Appeal or
the federal court?
So you look Cachetto here. If your link is the Court of Appeal.
Oh, well,
that's all right. We can find the...
I can give you the citation.
History, and here is the federal court. 2023 FC 102.
That's the one.
Justice Penn. All right, I have that.
Yes, and so they make the following statement at paragraph 32. While the applicant is clearly frustrated that none of the decision makers have addressed what he sees as the fundamental legal or factual issues that he raises, for example, regarding bodily integrity, consent to medical testing, the safety and efficacy of the COVID-19 vaccines or antigen tests, that does not make the decision of the appeal division unreasonable. The key problem with the applicant's argument is that he is criticizing decision makers for failing to deal with a set of questions they are not by law permitted to address. Here, the risk of significant and irreversible harm is not part of the factual basis for refusing the employer's demand in Cachetto, because his employer did not require him to be vaccinated, since Mr. Cachetto had the alternative option of non-intrusive testing rather than vaccination. The federal court's statement at paragraph 32 of Cachetto is not the result of a substantive analysis of statutory interpretation of the word misconduct, nor is it the result of a substantive analysis by the jurisdictional limits of the tribunal to consider certain types of evidence in determining misconduct. It is not necessary to deal with the issue. Instead, it is an obiter dictum statement that can be removed from the decision without changing the result of the decision. Also, the case of Cachetto is distinguished from mine in that first, Mr. Cachetto worked in a hospital in various roles with no option of working from home. Mr. Cachetto would have necessarily been in contact or proximity to hospital staff, vulnerable patients, and other members of the public. Person-to-person contact was required by his work. Whereas in my case, I worked entirely from home. All of my colleagues worked entirely from home, such that I had no contact with any of my colleagues or with any other person as part of my work. And secondly, Mr. Cachetto's employer offered him the option of rapid antigen testing instead of being vaccinated. Therefore, the employer in Cachetto did not require that the employee become vaccinated. Whereas in my case, my employer did not offer me the option of testing instead of vaccination. My employer required me to be vaccinated. The second case is Sullivan versus Canada. And the federal court is judging.
Sullivan?
Sullivan, yes.
You have this new list? Yes, you do. Court of Appeal. Yes, I have them.
2024 FCA 7.
Yes.
In the case of Sullivan, the Federal Court of Appeal panel stated at paragraphs 4 and 5, the appeal division rejected the applicant's argument. Following applicable court jurisprudence, for example, Canada versus McNamara, Parenti versus Canada, and Cachetto versus Canada, the appeal division held that the test for misconduct focuses on the employee's knowledge and actions, not on the employer's behavior or the reasonableness of its work policy. It added that the applicant could pursue remedies elsewhere if he considered that his employer treated him improperly. In our view, the appeal division's decision is reasonable. It is supported by the evidentiary record before it and applicable court jurisprudence. The case of Sullivan is distinguished from mine. The claimant worked as a security guard with no option of working from home. In the Sullivan case, the claimant submitted to the tribunal a medical note from a doctor dated several months prior to his employer's implementation of its vaccination mandate, stating that the claimant should not receive a COVID-19 vaccine due to his past history of allergic reactions to vaccine. And that is stated in the general division decision in paragraphs 31 to 32. The SSD appeal division held the following in paragraph 30. The general division considered the note from the claimant's doctor and specifically refers to it in its decision. The claimant was asked questions about the note. The general division determined that, according to the policy, the medical proof had to be satisfactory to the employer, and the claimant's note was not. Here, the irrationality of the formulating application of the recent test for misconduct is revealed.
So you say Sullivan is wrongly decided?
I have not given that as part of my submission.
Well, I think that's the implication of what you're saying. You're telling me that your case is distinguishable and you're referring to patents, right? But the question for me in a court on judicial review is there a distinction in law? And if you look at paragraph 4, the Court of Appeal, which of course then seems to bind on me, say that the appeal division followed applicable court jurisprudence, held the test for misconduct focuses on the employee's knowledge and actions, not on the employer's behavior or the reasonableness of work policy. And I have to tell you, I have difficulty understanding how your case doesn't fall within that framework of analysis.
Well,
so, in your case, the appeal division focused on your knowledge and your actions, not on the employer's behavior or the reasonableness of its policies. You keep telling me that you're not challenging the policy, but then you keep telling me how unreasonable it is for the employer to require vaccination or for the employee to work from home.
I disagree. This case, judicial review, is about the tribunal's analysis of the fraudulent case. And my argument is that in that analysis, the tribunal is looking at the employee's action, trying to decide if that's misconduct or not.
That's right.
They have to, in my case, in cases like mine, they have to include in their analysis the fact that the thing the employer was requiring.
Whether it's reasonable or not.
No, they have to consider the fact that the thing the employer was requiring could cause potentially fatal harm.
And therefore was unreasonable.
I respectfully disagree. It's not about reasonableness of the policy. It's about the SST decision makers analysis.
But you told me the employer's policy was unnecessary, put you at unreasonable risk. How are these not criticisms of the employer's policy?
Um, asking the tribunal, the commission, the Canadian Environment Assurance Commission, has labeled what I did, which is to decline vaccination and pursue my employer's accommodation policy.
Yes.
The commission has labeled that as misconduct. And now the tribunal has to decide whether that action of mine really was misconduct or not. When the tribunal makes that consideration, they have to, in my case, given the record, the evidence on the record, which is uncontested, the tribunal has to consider the risk of harm to the employee. They cannot divorce that and not consider it. To do that is inappropriate and it is inconsistent with the spirit and intent of the act. That's my argument. I'm not arguing about the response.
But you want to say that your behavior was justified because the demand made of you was unreasonable.
I would like the tribunal to consider, properly, fully consider my action, which is an action of refusal. In an action of refusal, to fully consider that action, you need to ask and consider what was given. And when you do that as a decision maker, you cannot always, in all cases, exclude that there could be a harm to the employee from complying with the employer's demand. That would lead to absurd results. And I've
But the
explained that
tribunal
in
say that
my factual
you
background.
want them to engage in labor law analysis rather than just focusing on whether you made an informed choice to do what you did.
I disagree. It's not labor law analysis. It's not about wrongful dismissal. It's not about workplace who is right, who's wrong. It's really about there's a record before the tribunal. That record has uncontested evidence of harm. That harm has to be, in this case, has to be part of the decision of this consideration. You cannot just exclude that.
Well, the tribunal would say, no, you pursue that in a different form. You pursue that by way of grievance. If you say the employer is unreasonably exposing you to a risk of harm, that's a labor law issue. That's not a question of entitlement to ER benefits.
The Employment Insurance Act, the benefits regime, is not meant to be used this way. It's not meant. It's
I mean,
not.
you want me to depart from every other case that this court has decided and the Court of Appeals has decided. And say for the first time, the definition of misconduct allows the tribunal to consider what the employer's demand was and whether that put the employee to risk.
The other cases are not binding on my case, which is. Well, they haven't, of course, tested the section of my presentation right now. So there's that. And the other thing is that there is no statutory definition of misconduct. So it is up to the courts to apply an appropriate definition in the case before it, and for the tribunal to do
Yes.
that.
Okay.
And so the employment insurance regime, the benefits regime, is not meant to be applied in this way, where the evaluation of misconduct can, or a formula for evaluating misconduct that is applied irrespective of the facts of the case and the employee's reason, that it can be used to deny benefits in this way. That is contrary to the spirit of the act. So, when in Sullivan, when the SST Appeal Division held that the general division determined that the medical proof had to be satisfactory to the employer and against no, it was not, here we can see the irrationality of the formulaic application of the recent test or quote-unquote test for misconduct. The claimant in Sullivan provided a medical note stating he should not receive a COVID-19 vaccine due to past allergic reactions to vaccines. The employer wasn't satisfied with the note, and on this basis, the FSC found the employee had committed misconduct. What if the medical doctor's note had stated the employee had a 10% or a 50% chance of dying upon receiving a COVID-19 vaccine? Would the tribunal still find that the employer's rejection of the employee's medical note constituted misconduct on the part of the employee? And would the tribunal still consider itself to be acting in a manner consistent with the meaning and intent of the Employer Insurance Act?
How would it? Because the tribunal could say that's the kind of concern we should raise in the context of agreement.
Even in a case where the medical note said that you would have a 50% chance of dying.
Probably. Because of the difference in roles.
Well, that, in my submission, that illustrates the irrationality of the formulaic test and the absurd result. It's an example of kind of absurd result.
I mean, you would like the tribunal to have a larger jurisdiction than it seems to have. The tribunal looks at intentionality. And if you've got a labor law, like, we take that somewhere else. You would like the tribunal to have a broader scope of authority than something the tribunal thinks it has.
I think the tribunal is restrained to
Yes.
making decisions that are pursuant to the Employment Insurance Act. And when it makes those decisions have to be consistent with the meaning and intent of the Act. They also have to be consistent with charter rights and charter values. These decisions cannot be have results that clearly would infringe on people's charter rights. That has to be part of the analysis. If the employer is asking an employee to cause harm to some other person, that is illegal. That is clearly, and then that person gets fired for not complying, and then that person is not entitled to receive employment insurance benefits. That scenario would clearly be an absurd result of this formulaic application for test. And I submit that that is also the case in my case. Respectfully, it is clear from such a case as Sullivan that if the risk of significant and irreversible harm is part of both the factual basis and the stated employee's reason for not complying with the employer's demand, then the said risk must be part of the decision-maker's calculus in determining misconduct. The Federal Court of Appeal in Sullivan did not make any mention of the employee's medical note, and rather framed the issue on judicial review as follows in paragraph 3 of the FCA decision. The applicant argued before both divisions of the tribunal that he did not engage in misconduct on the job. Among other things, he focused on the validity of the employer's vaccination policy. Therefore, the issue of whether the risk of significant and irreversible harm, when it is part of both the factual basis and the stated employee's reason for not complying with the employer's demand, whether that must be part of the decision maker's calculus in determining misconduct, was not an issue before the Federal Court of Appeal in Sullivan.
So in Sullivan, paragraph 14, Justice Stratus writes, the applicant is certain he was wrongly dismissed. We sympathize with his plight. As a court of law, we are bound to apply the law. As mentioned above, the law is that the Social Security Tribunal cannot delve into whether the dismissal was proper or the reasonableness of the employer's policy that led to the dismissal. And I don't see how that doesn't apply to your case.
No, that does not apply to my case because, of course, the Social Security Tribunal is not a forum for debating whether dismissal is justified or not, or whether it was wrong for dismissal, whether or so forth. That is not the purview of the tribunal. It is purely concerned in cases like this with entitlement or disentitlement to employment insurance benefits.
I agree.
After losing.
Yes.
So those statements by the Federal Court of Appeal do not apply to them. Negate my submissions about what the tribunal needs to do when it does this problem.
But you keep insisting that where the Social Security Tribunal went wrong in your case is that they didn't take into account the nature of the demand the employer made of you. And yet, Sullivan tells me that the Social Security Tribunal doesn't consider the reasonableness of the policies that led to dismissal.
Sullivan When the Federal Court of Appeal in paragraph B talks about the validity of employers' vaccination policy, that is because Sullivan was arguing that he had provided the necessary information to support a medical exemption by providing his doctor's note that was from many months prior, from March 2021. And he didn't fill out the employer's forms that the employer required. And he argued that the policy wasn't, it was invalid for the policy to require him to fill those forms because that policy had a requirement that he waive confidentiality, and he argued that that violated his human rights. So when the FCA is talking about that the claimant focused on validity of the policy in paragraph three, that's what they're talking about. And that is, those are entirely different circumstances in most cases.
Well, I can see the factual difference, but the legal difference is not clear.
That's different legal issues, whether he is arguing that the policy is unreasonable, it's invalid, because in his view, it was wrong that the employer was asking him to waive his confidentiality and give his medical information to some evaluator, presumably that would be evaluating his case, and that he argued that that violated his human rights. So that is a different matter, different legal issue, different fact. So that the core thing that I'm arguing, which is that this issue of whether the risk of significant and irreversible harm, when it is part of both the factual basis and the stated employee's reason for not complying with the employer's demand, whether that must be part of the decision maker's calculus in determining this conduct, was not an issue before the Federal Court of Appeal in Sullivan. And as such, the Sullivan Federal Court of Appeal decision cannot be binding on the court in my instant judicial review. I will also add that in Sullivan, the claimant's medical note related to his past medical history regarding allergic reactions to previous vaccines, which were not COVID vaccines. Mr. Sullivan had not provided any scientific documentation regarding potential harm to him from a COVID-19 vaccine, which is another factor distinguishing the case of Sullivan from my case. The third case that I would like to discuss is Wong versus Canada, and it's the Federal Court of Appeal decision.
So this is in your list.
Quickly.
Yes, I see it, number 13. So this is Justice O'Reilly.
I'm not sure, but I can give you the citation.
Sure, it's 2024 FC 686.
Oh no, that must be the federal court. I have the Court of Appeal here.
Ah, yes, just a moment. Court of Appeal, 2025 FC 63.
Yes, that's the one.
I have that.
Okay. The claimant in Wong argued at the tribunal that one of the reasons her refusal to be vaccinated was not misconduct, but was because the vaccine was dangerous to her health. For example, in paragraph 17 of the FST General Division decision. However, there is no indication in any of the SST General Division, SST Appeal Division, Federal Court, or Federal Court of Appeal decisions in Wong that the claimant entered any evidence to document potential harms from the COVID-19 vaccines. Also, the claimant worked at the Toronto Public Library, and there is no indication in any of the decisions in Wong that the claimant worked from home. Therefore, Wong is distinguished from my case. As such, the Federal Court of Appeal panel's statement in Wong at paragraph 5 that, quote, "the meaning of misconduct for the purposes of the EI Act is settled by the jurisprudence of this court, and we are bound by it," end quote, is not a statement that is binding on my case, because the factual matrix and legal issues at play in Wong, as well as in all the cases cited by the FCA panel in paragraph 5 of Wong, distinguish it from my case. None of those cited cases involve a factual context in which the first instance and forward records contain received evidence of significant risk of serious permanent harm from the COVID vaccines, and the employee was working entirely from home. Other cases, none of the other cases of misconduct pursuant to the EI Act for refusing vaccination are binding on the court in the instant case, because the pivotal facts and or the addressed legal issues in those cases are different. And my final section of my submission representation is addressing two specific points in the respondent's submissions.
Yes.
The first point, at paragraph 6 of the respondent's memorandum of fact and law, the respondent makes the following statement, which refers solely to my initial letter of November 12, 2021, to my employer requesting an exemption to its vaccination policy. Quote, the applicant offered no evidence of a condition that would prevent him from receiving the vaccine. Instead, his exemption request largely relied on news articles to represent that he, as a male in his 30s, was at the highest risk of adverse impacts from the vaccine. Therefore, the respondent is implicitly admitting that the safety of the COVID vaccines is relevant to the SST's determination in my case. More importantly, the respondent's statement is misleading because it completely ignores my March 2022 internal appeal submitted to my employer and included in the record before the SST General Division, which contains extensive scientific evidence about the health risks of the vaccine to males under 40, my age and sex group, including many peer-reviewed scientific articles, as I have summarized earlier in these oral submissions. My employer received and evaluated my March 2022 internal appeal and provided responses maintaining its decision to deny me an accommodation. And those responses are also on the record at pages 797 to 799 and 813 to 817 of my record for this judicial review. Also, in my initial exemption request to my employer dated November 12, 2021, which begins at page 254 of my record for this judicial review, I cited Public Health Ontario's what's called its weekly surveillance summary adverse events following immunization for COVID-19 in Ontario, which showed that males in my age group, I was 36 at the time, were at higher risk of adverse events following vaccination than older males, older females, or younger females. And Public Health Ontario was a government agency. I also cited several media articles reporting that many countries around the world had canceled their recommendations of some COVID-19 vaccines, including mRNA COVID-19 vaccines for younger males. I submitted my March 2022 internal appeal, as well as the November 12, 2021 initial exemption request letter to the CEIC, the Commission, and they formed part of the documentary record on which the CEIC made its final decision to deny the EI benefits issued on June 17th, 2022. The second point, that paragraph 26 of the respondent's memorandum, the respondent states, quote, the applicant's assertion that misconduct requires criminal intent, morally abhorrent or reprehensible behavior is wrong in law. Now, this is a misrepresentation. Contrary to the respondent's statement, I am not arguing that criminal intent, morally abhorrent, or reprehensible behavior is required in order for there to be misconduct pursuant to the EI Act. Instead, I wrote the following in my amended application for leave to appeal to the SST Appeal Division at paragraph 3rd, which is at page 2319 of my record in this judicial review. Quote, the incorrect and explicit methodology for determining misconduct applied by Member Bourgeois, carving out the employer directive being refused by the employee, leads to absurd results when one considers cases that go beyond traditional workplace misconduct, such as death or consuming alcohol or illegal drugs during working hours. My statement was about how the methodology applied by the tribunal for determining misconduct can lead to absurd results in cases where the employer's demand is not benign or legal on the face of the facts, or is not an objectively necessary part of the employment. I mentioned theft or consuming illegal drugs during working hours as examples of situations where the tribunal's chosen methodology for determining misconduct would be appropriate. The respondent included a footnote, which is footnote 52, at its said statement of paragraph 26 of its memorandum. Footnote 52 refers to paragraph 26 of the SST appeal division decision denying me to appeal to my bar. I heard paragraph 26. SST appeal division member Janet Liu states, quote, the claimant argues that misconduct typically involves criminal, morally abhorrent, or reprehensible behavior, such as stealing, consuming alcohol, or taking illicit drugs during working hours. The claimant says that unless any conduct is of this nature, then that conduct does not qualify as misconduct. This statement by member Liu shows that she incorrectly understood and misrepresented my argument. I did not argue that, quote, unless any conduct is of this nature, which is criminal or morally reprehensible or abhorrent, then that conduct is not qualified as misconduct. Rather, I argued that carving out the employer's demand as irrelevant, that is, categorically refusing to consider the nature of the employer's demand, can lead to absurd results in some cases, which includes cases in which the employer's demand requires that the employee expose himself to unnecessary risk of harm as severe as death, as is the case with mandatory COVID-19 vaccination for an employee who is in an age and sex group exposed to scientifically proven health risks from the vaccine while working entirely from home with no physical contact with any colleague or any other person in this part of his work. And this completes my prepared submission.
All right, thank you. Well, we'll hear from the Crown, and then we will have the right to reply.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Ferris?
Nothing about this. The respondent's position that this judicial review should be dismissed. The appeal division's decision is reasonable and grounded in the law of this conduct. The applicant continues to argue more of the same without actually pointing out any flaw in the appeal division decision beyond re-arguing his case. Disagreement with the outcome is not a basis for judicial review. In support of this position, the respondent will make the following submission. I will note, since the applicant has abandoned his charter-based arguments, I will not address those unless necessary. So my submission today will focus on the fact that the appeal division and the general division both properly understood and applied the law of misconduct in reaching the conclusions that they did. Neither the general division nor the appeal division erred in its approach to the misconduct test and how it applies to the applicant's circumstances. The general division cited the correct test of paragraph 12 and 13, mainly that misconduct will occur where a claimant acts deliberately, willfully, or intentionally in a way that their conduct resulted in dismissal or suspension. The general division pointed out that misconduct does not require wrongful intent for misconduct to be present. All of this is supported by case law, including Misha Binjani and Sikoris, no matter how many times I practice that, I will never pronounce it correctly, and is supported by the recent jurisprudence coming from this court and the Federal Court of Appeal. The general division made no error in applying the law. It assessed the facts and found that the applicant was suspended because he failed to comply with his employer's policy, of which he was aware of the consequences in advance and was denied exemption to the policy. There is no error in this analysis or in the outcome.
So I wonder, your friend says there must be a limit to this. And we do have one case in the investigation right now of the individual who refused to go to work because the workplace was unsafe. If you had hypothetically an employer who required that an employee engage in something criminal, would that have any bearing on whether the employee had engaged in misconduct?
Absolutely. So let me just quickly pull up the Employment Insurance Act. So I believe
it's Estolfi is the case.
Yes, Estolfi, yes.
Yeah, so Estolfi is interesting because that is one case where this court felt it was appropriate for the tribunal to consider the nature of what is going on in the workplace when assessing voluntariness. Is that not applicable here?
It's the respondent's position that no, it's not applicable here, mainly for the reasons that the appeal division expressed in its decision.
Yes.
Alluding to ABDO in Canada, which is another federal court of appeal case that deals with COVID-19 vaccination policies.
Yes.
mainly the distinction between Asfalvi and the case that's before us, and he argued with asbestos,
Yes.
is that there was a broad policy that applied to all employees of Bank of Canada. It wasn't Mr. Hickey getting singled out himself. So in this sense, there's no need to assess, and the tribunal can't assess sort of the conduct of the employer in this scenario, because it's not one that would attract that sort of scrutiny. But I will also point out that Section 29 of the EI deals with voluntary leaving.
Yes.
Typically, it covers things where human rights violations or scenarios where an employee would be required to leave because of some sort of thing.
Because of an unsafe workplace.
Like an unsafe workplace, or to be asked to, do something that's criminal.
See, Mr. Hickey says this policy did render him unsafe. It exposed him to risk of serious physical harm if you comply with it.
Yes, and I understand your point there, but I will refer back to something that you said earlier, that it wasn't requiring him to get the vaccine, it's just that there was consequences if he didn't get the vaccine.
Yes.
So there was...
I do think one challenge for Mr. Hickey is that he's not the first person to make this argument, and that this has come through court before, and out of court appeal before. Otherwise, I think I might have a little bit more scope to decide in his favor, because, I think Astolfi is possibly analogous, possibly, at least, and I'm mindful of the fact that this is a decision denying the appeal. Say that there's nothing you can even argue here. So that's a pretty low threshold. So if it weren't for the other cases that come before dealing specifically with vaccines, I might say, well, it's at least arguable. But I'm not sure post cases like Sullivan. But I have some sympathy for Mr. Hickey's position, which is to say he didn't engage in misconduct in the normal sense of the word. He had a principled objection to the employer's policies. And I'm just wondering, so at what point can an employee say this policy is so outrageous that I shouldn't be expected to comply?
I see your point, certainly. If we take it to that sort of hypothetical, how far can we push
this? Yes.
I don't have the answer to the hypothetical, but I will know there are cases, and unfortunately this was not cited in the respondent's record, but it's CABA in Canada, and I can give you
the citation number, sir.
It's 2007 FC 647.
Yes.
And in this decision, it's one that I just draw by way of analogy, that the individual, he was found that he had good misconduct for violence in the workplace, but the violence resulted from a altercation with another person at the workplace who had made a racist comment about his wife, and he hit that person. So we have these sort of, yes, it's good to, hit somebody who's racist, or, sort of correct that racist behavior, but in the end, even though his actions were rooted in good intentionality, he was still denied EI benefits because violence in the workplace was not accepted as his physical employment.
So it still comes down to voluntariness.
Yes.
Yes.
That's correct. And that's why I know my friend, or the applicant, has indicated that the tribunal is sort of making this error of not looking at things on a case-by-case basis.
Yes.
But as we look at the jurisprudence, and I cite CABA as an example, the tribunal has been engaged in that throughout. It's just the bulk of the COVID-19 vaccination misconduct files, they all typically have a somewhat fact pattern where there's been a policy imposed, the person doesn't comply with the policy, and termination or suspension result.
And I assume that the workplace grievances are ongoing, is that right?
I would assume so. I have no knowledge of it.
You don't know about that? Yeah. Because Mr. Hickey could have advanced these kinds of arguments in contact grievance.
Yes, and I believe my understanding is that he did have a workplace sort of not a grievance, but something resulting in. No?
No. I was not unionized. There's no possibility for agreements.
No.
It's a rare government position, let's say, where there's no at the Bank of Canada.
I understood that non-unionized employees can still file grievances.
My understanding is a grievance is a labor law arbitration proceeding.
It is. We don't need to get into that. But my understanding has been that non-unionized employees can still file grievances for workplace wrongdoing. It won't get a collective agreement, that's all. Amen.
And that's my understanding as well, that even non-unionized employees, there are such things as labor boards or civil suits, those kind of things where they hear, that have been referenced for the case law, specifically Sullivan, where there are other avenues where individuals can seek recourse for suspension or dismissal resulting from COVID-19 vaccination also.
Gentleman in the back who wants to be heard, I'm not sure who this is.
I'm sorry, can I ask a question?
What is your role in this proceeding?
Just a member of the public.
A member of the public. I'm sorry, no. This is a dispute between Mr. Hickey and the Crown. You can speak to Mr. Hickey perhaps he wants to advance a point that you have. But I'll give you that opportunity before we end to speak to Mr. Hickey. And Mr. Hickey can decide whether it's something that he wants to put forward and roll on.
Absolutely. So just continuing on in my submissions, I've already sort of addressed Astolfi, but just in terms of completeness for my little checklist here. So the appeal division addressed the applicant's leave arguments, mainly that the general division's application, sorry, mainly that the applicant, pardon me, mainly that the general division's application of the Astolfi decision was, there was no error in that. There was no extricable legal error. Second, whether the general division misinterpreted misconduct in sections 31 EIA. And that the general division erred by not considering its charter-based arguments. And as I indicated earlier, I will not address those unless necessary. So just in terms of the way in which the appeal division addressed this topic, I will just draw the court's attention to the fact that the appeal division declined to intervene on that potential error raised by Mr. Hickey was because of the fact that they found no issue with the way in which the general division understood or applied the Astolfi, there was no extricable legal error there. And of course, the appeal division.
The Astolfi deals with whether the situation is so grave that an individual's intentionality is affected.
Yes.
And right. I think that's the essence of the Astolfi case. And here I think it's pretty clear that Mr. Hickey behaved with intentionality and purpose and understanding of the consequences of his choice. But he still thinks that it can be misconduct without some consideration of the choice he was forced to make.
Yes, I agree that with your sort of formulation of the applicant's position. However, it's the respondent's position that the case law is clear that we're not looking at the subjective intentions in the sense of was this individual right and wrong in their actions? Just in the objective sense of...
Was he acting deliberately?
Yes, was he acting deliberately in assessing it through that lens, as opposed to assessing whether or not, you know, his firmly held beliefs of the vaccine are correct or any of that. It's just, was the action made, was it intentional?
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of that checking of the list in order to reach the end of this comment.
Yes.
But I will just note that the appeal division was correct in declining to intervene in that raised error because, as posited by Mr. Hickey, that error resulted in an error of mixed acting law because there was no extricable legal error in the way in which the general division dealt with the Astolfi decision. The appeal division made no error in doing so, and this is supported by the Federal Court of Appeal decisions in Garvey and Deer. The pinpoints can be found in footnote 43 and 44 of the respondent's memorandum. Similarly, the appeal division found that the general division did not err in its interpretation of misconduct under the EI Act. The appeal division considered the applicant's arguments that the general division should have considered the nature of the conduct, and this is sort of what we've been discussing throughout the hearing today.
Yes.
The appeal division and the respondent gleaned from his leave to appeal submissions that he was drawing a comparison of conduct, which is morally reprehensible or criminal, and if it's not. And to that point, the appeal division addressed that, citing to Zagel in Canada, which is a little bit of a decision.
What paragraph are you looking at in the lead decision?
What paragraph 30?
Yes.
So the appeal division aptly pointed out, citing Zagel and from paragraph 27 of Zagel, that it is not necessary for a claim of misconduct to be blameworthy or to attract any discipline. Misconduct results as long as the applicant conducted themselves with the knowledge that consequences might flow. And this is supported by, a litany of federal court of appeal and federal court decisions dealing with misconduct. I'll just say to the federal court of appeal in Beasley, which is cited in the respondent's record, specifically at Beasley at paragraph 5, says misconduct under this test does not require malicious or wrong behavior. And the court went further in paragraph 5, saying consistently and repeatedly, this court has said that whether under applicable labor laws the employer was justified in dismissing the employee is irrelevant to applying the misconduct for that purpose. So that's referring back to that, that sort of, it doesn't have to be a wrong behavior or malicious or any criminal intent, that we're not looking whether or not the employer was justified, as you've indicated. You know, there's ever other avenues for employees to seek recourse for when they're unjustifiably let go. And the court in here, just for the benefit, it relied on the Mishabina Jimmy at paragraph 21, cited to Canada and Marion at paragraph 3, Canada and McNamara at paragraph 22.
Canada, so is this from the
and yes, and easily at paragraph 5.
Paragraph 5.
So it's the court there went through the...
Yes, it was public, yes.
Yes, went through the exercise of sort of relying on all the preceding case law.
I see this is not a vaccination case.
Yes, and in the fact that it's not a vaccination case.
Point, no, it is a vaccination
case. Oh, it is a vaccination case? Sorry, yes. My apologies. But it is consistent throughout, even the cases cited, but many of them are well before the advent of the COVID-19 vaccination.
Yeah.
Or sorry, the COVID, even the pandemic itself. So we have 2007, 2002, 2010.
Busy says the test for misconduct is well established whether the claimant knew or ought to have known their conduct, in this case, Mr. Bentley's decision not to become vaccinated, would result in dismissal.
Yes, yeah, so very aptly put it. And moving on to my last point regarding the general division and appeal division decisions. The courts have been resoundingly clear that arguments about constitutionality, merit, or validity of an employer policy is not the focus of misconduct analysis. And this has been a point throughout the hearing today. Rather, there are more appropriate venues for people to challenge employer policies, and this, of course, comes from Sullivan, which you've cited, specifically at paragraph 6. Similarly, the applicant's personal research or understanding is not relevant to misconduct analysis. This is ostensibly the same as the applicant's previous argument, which is the basis of his contention is with his employers and policy imposing mandatory vaccines. He's also actually making a challenge to the policy and not, I mean, and this is not a consideration for the Employment Insurance Commission. We're focused solely on the determination of whether or not it's entitled to the IR benefits. I will just also note for the court's benefit, the applicants raised a number of decisions highlighting the factual differences as a means to distinguish his case from those who have gone before him. I will note in Francis and Canada, which is cited at the applicant's record, paragraph 48, in the underlying appeal division decision at paragraph 33, the appellant there similarly argued that working from home should be factored into the misconduct analysis. I will just note he was not successful with this argument for the appeal division and the federal court of appeal deemed that decision reasonable.
This is Francis.
Francis, yes.
What court of appeal?
So looking at the specific information about the appellant's work situation is detailed in paragraph 33 of the underlying appeal division decision.
Okay, but not in the time of the court of appeal.
No, the court of appeal decision is quite brief. It's the respondent's position that the applicant has not raised an argument that impugns the reasonableness of the appeal division's decision at this point. He is asking this court to rehear his matter anew and to re-argue his case. It's the respondent's position that the decision meets the hallmarks of that law in terms of transparency, justifiability, and intelligibility, as it is grounded in the well-defined body of misconduct jurisprudence. Barring any further questions from the bench, this concludes the respondent's submissions.
Thank you. Respondent, seeking costs.
Yes, we are.
In what amount?
I don't have a submission on the amount.
Under the tariff, then?
Under the tariff, yes, that's right.
Right, Mr. Hickey, you have a right to reply. I don't know if you want to confer with anybody behind you, but that's entirely you, of course.
Is it possible to have a third hearing?
Yes.
Yes.
Would 5 minutes be sufficient, or do you want more than that?
Could you repeat, sir?
Would 5 minutes be sufficient, or would you like more than that?
10 minutes.
10 minutes. We will take 10 minutes.
Order. Court is in recess for 10 minutes. Court is now resumed.
Thank you.
At one point, your honor, I believe, said that I had had a principled objection to my employer's policy. And I would like to rephrase that, that my submission is that about a principled objection, it's about the harm that's on the record to me that is uncontested, that must be considered by the tribunal to see the constitutional kind of. That's the core of the issues.
I'm struggling with the distinction you're trying to make here. You say that you faced an unacceptable risk of harm if you complied with the employer's policy.
That's right. What I had said to the tribunal is that they must consider the documented risk of harm in their analysis of this company. To sever that and to exclude that whatsoever is contrary to the intent of the act. In all the cases where that has been done before, that relates to vaccination and misconduct, they're not finding them. And I also argue in my member opinion that to apply such a formula is this. It's new or this recent definition of misconduct that we're discussing in a formulaic way amounts to arbitrary state action. No employee could prove that their actions would be found to be misconduct irrespective of refusing the employer's demand would be found to be misconduct irrespective of any consideration of what that demand was. So when there is bad law that's developed by the tribunals and upheld on judicial review, it is the role of the court, the constitutional role of the court, to correct that law. When it is something that amounts to arbitrary state action, that is anathema to the rule of law. It's the role of the court to come in and correct that. And if you should do that, you see the correctness review. And I cite the scholarship of Contrail in my memorandum to that effect. I do want to mention that I would like to rely on contents of my memorandum regarding issue one. As I said, I've withdrawn issue two, but there are additional aspects of the argument that are in the written submissions. for issue one. You asked the Attorney General if they had, or you asked the Attorney General where would the limit be in terms of when the tribunal would consider the nature of the employer's demand. And the Attorney General had no response to that question. The Attorney General does not oppose the concept that there would be a limit. I submit that there must be such a limit. And no case has considered where that limit would be. I respectfully submit that the court should address that point, and that needs to be there needs to be such a limit, which means that you cannot sever consideration of what became required by the employer in all of these sorts of companies and analysts. The respondent cited the case of Pava, 2007 SC 647, if I got it right.
Is that the one that was in the list, or is that a different one?
I don't believe it's in the list, but I think that is what the respondent was referring to about violence in the workplace.
All right, I can bring that up if that's helpful.
Well, I wanted to make sure that I had noted it correctly. The Attorney General said it is good to hit somebody with places.
Is that the 7?
Oh, actually, I apologize. Sorry,
it's okay.
That's the wrong citation.
I see.
Let me just quickly pull up.
There is a case called Cabot at that site, but
it's not the correct. I'll just quickly.
We'll come back to that point.
Well, I looked up this case that I know it down, which was 2007, FC 647, have up.
Yes.
And I know that this is a case about immigration.
It is, yes. Just
and,
before.
And there's nothing in the respondent's list of case law that relates to this case. And I haven't had a chance to study it.
Right.
And I had a short breaking out with this one about immigration. I guess that objects to.
Yes, you're right to that. And sorry, I won't consider that unless your friend wants to give me a different citation, and I'll certainly give you an opportunity to respond to that even in writing.
Okay,
yes.
So I do have the correct citation now.
All right, what is it?
It's 2013, yes. FCA.
FCA.
208.
208. Let's just bring that up.
And my apologies for the incorrect citation.
What were the last numbers?
208. So this is also called CABA. That's true. But CABA lost his employment after he slapped a female co-worker who assaulted members of his family. Board of Referees found that Plan's actions did not constitute misconduct, disqualifying him from receiving benefits. He departed from that decision, and then the Court of Appeal overturns this. Test for misconduct is whether the act complaint was willful, Whatever it is, Mr. Powell's violent act was not deliberate. However, the above factors, like Mr. Powell's act, was put forward with the problem. So, broad decision just really confirms that misconduct just means conduct which is deliberate.
Then, is it correct that the claimant was transmitted on the trip?
And it was originally, and then the court of appeal overturned it. So I can see the relevance of this. Essentially, this is a case where the umpire, which is a previous role, but anyway, the person who determined the eligibility for benefits thought that the behavior was not deliberate was the finding, because I suppose there was extreme complication.
At first instance,
and that was confirmed. So, but then the court of appeal says no, that's the wrong test, because the behavior wasn't. That's really what the case stands for. But the misconduct, and I think that it is an important point that misconduct doesn't mean blameworthy. It just means deliberate behavior, which is counterintuitive. Because misconduct suggests that some kind of judgment is being announced. But in fact, it's not. It's the distinction between things which are beyond someone's control and things that are within someone's control. And that's what the BI benefit assessment is geared towards. So did you lose your job because of something you did deliberately? Or did you lose your job because of something you did not do deliberately? That really seems to be the only question they're concerned with. As we've counted before, if you have a complaint about the employer's demands, that's more suitable for a grievance. If it's true that you have a grievance right, then you can sue. But it is my understanding that even non-unionized employees can find grievances by workplace conditions.
HABA is a case that is in the category of cases where I submitted that the current test for misconduct would be appropriate. It's clearly,
yes, because
workplace violence is a clear and obvious action of the employee where it's clear that the could lead to dismissal or suspension.
Yes.
And the test is okay. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So there's nothing new or limiting about this in my submission.
I agree.
What I'm arguing is that there's some cases where that test is not adequate. It's missing an element. It's that to comply with the spirit of the test, you need to consider what is being demanded of the employee. And when there's documented signs of evidence of harm, it becomes an employee from complying. It's argued by the employee and there's a no need for the intervention to the opportunity to perform the work, then that must be considered by its analysis. I do want to mention, I think that this is just for context, and it's stated in my submissions. When the vaccination mandate was lifted in June 2022, I was not brought back to work, and I ended the employment by mutual agreement with my employer.
Yes.
So that is what happened for the context of my case.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not relevant to this case, which concerns respiratory at the start of the some suspension for that second. Thank you. Or more because the written finals in October. If I heard it correctly, I believe Your Honor said that Mr. Hickey wants some consideration of the choice he was forced to make.
Yes.
With nuanced stuff, and so I want consideration of the fact on the record, proof and risk of harm to them in the analysis of it. That's what needs to be assumed. That harm report is real, is on the record, is uncontested. That needs to be part of the analysis of the tribunal and deciding whether an action constitutes misconduct. The Attorney General said the applicant's personal research is not relevant to the misconduct analysis. With respect, that misses the point. It's not my personal research that is at issue, it's uncontested scientific documentation on the record of harm that would be exposed to the risk of harm from complying that needs to be considered by the tribunal. What's the discussion of Section 49 of the Bar regarding voluntarily with or without just cause and whether it's not safe or twice in that case can be just cause or against voluntary leave? I have a section, which is Section 3.25 of my program. The heading section is the SST's adopted definition of misconduct enables the express government coercion to become vaccinated or be denied, which is contrary to the purpose of the act. So I explain, I give in the paragraphs in that section, I give the context of situation at the time, which was that the social and political context of the governmental directive to implement vaccination was one in which the state expressed the denial of EI as part of its planned coercion. The state employees the objective. So the state intended to force its employees to be vaccinated, and the government's use of EI denial as an instrument to coerce employees was widely criticized by civil society, including the CCLA, and I quote from that article, the cadence of the association statute of the Minister of Department about that issue dated 1st of November. Now, that this denial is part of the government's planned coercion for the public sector employees to become vaccinated, in addition to the employment, is against the embedded regime especially something that violates their charter rights. You're supposed to have strong rights in Canada as an individual to be free from coercion to receive a medical treatment. There's about many Supreme Court of Canada decisions to that effect. I've cited them in my record. They are in my amended application for appeal. And it falls under Section 7 of the Charter of Choices. Also, Section 2 of the Charter is relevant for conscious and freedom of religion. Section 7 of life, liberty, and security of the person are all relevant in that respect. You're not supposed to be coerced by the government. So when they used PI kind of decision as a tool to get people to get vaccinated, benefits regime is being used in a long way.
Now, this is really a new argument, it's not a reply. So, the purpose of reply is to respond to things that the Crown argued. And you're now invoking the Charter, having told me that you were not pursuing Charter arguments.
I'm not pursuing issue two of Margaret. Mm-hmm. This is an issue one, by the way. I don't want to repeat it because it's there and I want to rely on it.
No, I'm sorry, I was lying on your submission.
Yes. But the reason I'm bringing that down reply is that there was talk and discussion about Section 29.
I see.
And this section of my memorandum relates to Section 29. So the application by the tribunal of misconduct to mean intentionally refusing to follow an employer's directive regardless of the nature of the record, contradicts the broader statutory context of the BI Act and ignores that the BI Act provides for a large category of voluntary employee actions for refusing employer directives that do not disqualify the employee from the evidence. Said large category of voluntary employee actions with refusing employer directives that would not disqualify an employee from receiving EI are listed in section 29C, subsection 1 to 14 of the EI Act, and included working conditions that constitute a danger to health or safety. Now, the inclusion of the list of valid reasons for leaving employer in section 29C of the EI Act shows that the legislature intended to allow that certain employee refusals of employer directives must not result in disqualification for the EI. So the SST's adopted behavior of misconduct using the formula willfully disobeyed a man equals misconduct irrespective of what is being demanded contradicts the intention of the legislature and is untenable considering the broader statute of practice. Also, in my case, the commissions, the Employment Insurance Commission, initially decided to deny me benefits on the basis that I had voluntarily left work at Veterans College. That's in my memorandum, it's a footnote, but you can see that document in the record. Then, following my request for reconsideration, the CIC changed its decision from denying me benefits to voluntarily leaving without just comes to deny me benefits due to misconduct. The fact that the commission initially considered my employer's suspension to be a case of voluntary leaving without just cause shows the importance of the broader context of the EI Act. Had the commission maintained its allegation that I voluntarily left work without just cause, then the tribunal would have been more confined to consider my evidence that my employer requiring me to be vaccinated created working conditions that constitute a danger to health or safety, which is like the section 29C, sub 4 of the EI Act. The CEIC did not provide one iota of evidence to the tribunal regarding the safety, efficacy, or lack thereof of the COVID vaccines. The decisions below did not address the raised issue in this subsection, which is that the formula locally disordered in an equals this conduct irrespective of what is being committed allows the EI Act and the EI benefits program to be used for employees to be vaccinated, which is contrary to the intention of the EI Act. That means that the decisions below are unreasonable on the basis of failure to provide reasonable. So I wanted to highlight that these came in submissions in response to this discussion section. There was discussion of the case of SMU, if that's important to you. And Bensley is distinguished from my case. In my submissions today, I gave, I argued that all of the cases that have been put forward, this court in the federal appeal, for vaccination and misconduct, well, for refusing vaccination, those are all distinguished from my case. And I gave three examples for my more depth, but Bensley is in that category as well. It's distinguished. And Nicolette worked in the Toronto Transit Commission. There's no indication of an option to work from home. There's no indication in any of the general mission ability or appeal to fit decisions. That Leslie submitted documentation regarding potential labor of the vaccine. So this is a distinguished case. Francis as well was mentioned.
Yes.
And that case is also distinguished from mine. Francis will take a look at it. There was some note in the general division decision of Francis that he had safety concerns with the vaccine. And there's a note that he submitted evidence regarding some of his arguments. There's a whole list of arguments. The general division said he did not have authority to decide it, but there's no indication in any of the general division, field division, or the federal court of judicial review, or the FCA decisions that Francis can submitted scientific evidence of harmful person in its age and sex category. And the appeal division considered not mention Francis's concerns about safety at all. It's a focus on his arguments about his conduct, not being misconduct due to his lack of choice, but it's due to his religious beliefs. It's a case that's all about religious beliefs, and that not being vaccinated, not misconduct, because he his religious beliefs prevented him from being vaccinated. So the appeal division onwards, there's no mention of safety being an issue. So the FCA's decision in Francis does not concern safety in the factual matrix or as a legal issue, and therefore Francis is a court of decision is distinguished from that case. And I think, I hope that if you read my memorandum of fact and law, you will see that I'm not trying to have the argument reheard. I'm treating this as a judicial review where I need to apply the methodology for judicial review to the government relations decision. And regarding also an aspect of scientific responsibility.
Well, thank you. I will look at all your submissions again in the case law again, specifically to see if it's proven that it can be distinguished. And for that reason, judgment will be reserved.
Order. Order is now concluded.